are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, February 1st, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, writing in the Rolling Stone magazine, how the GOP rigs elections. Ari Berman will be joining us. Senior writer at Mother Jones, author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. And now to Michael Brooks with today's headlines.
Hey, folks. Mike Pence has an aggressive plan to save the Republican majority in 2018. Means basically campaigning across the country, even though he's incredibly unpopular. Who is in Donald Trump's crosshairs next? It could be Christopher Wray. Trump asked Rod Rosenstein if he was, quote unquote, on his team. Schiff accuses Devin Nunes of making secret changes to the infamous memo before sending it to Trump. And one line from Donald Trump's somehow both incredibly boring and incredibly disgusting State of the Union speech is already a rallying cry for white supremacists. Cape Town tightening down water usage as they move towards a water-free, complete drought in Cape Town, South Africa. Climate change and actual failure of neoliberal governance. All that, much more. I'm going to be here in the fun half, everybody. And we've got a few pieces of business that we got to jump attend to before we get to the interview with Ari Berman. Window treatments is one of those soulless adulting terms for something necessary but boring as
It's boring.
It's boring. Your blinds. Necessary but boring. You don't even think about them unless you move or they break. When they're right, everything in your home looks better. But when they're wrong, everything in your home looks cheap. Let's be honest. Taking the time to pick out and buy blinds sounds expensive, kind of boring. And installing them yourself sounds harder than any self-respecting adult wants to admit. I actually have no problem admitting that. It sounds like an incredible pain in the ass. But Blinds.com makes it really easy for you. Not sure what you want or even where to start? With Blinds.com, you get a free online design consultation. Just send them a picture of your house, and they send back custom recommendations from a professional for what will work with your color, scheme, furniture, and specific rooms. They'll even send you free samples to make sure everything looks as good in person as it does online, and every order gets free shipping. And this is the best part. If you accidentally mismeasure or pick the wrong color, if you screw up, Blinds.com will remake your blinds for free. They've made it really easy for you, so there's no excuse to leave up those mangled blinds that make your place look like it's from the set of The Wire. And for a limited time, get up to 20% off of everything at Blinds.com when you use the promo code MAJORITY. That's Blinds.com, promo code MAJORITY for 20% off of everything. Wood blind, faux wood blinds, cellular shades, roller shades, and more. Blinds.com, promo code MAJORITY, rules and restrictions apply. And one rule and restriction that we all need to live by is brushing our teeth. I'm going to say at least twice a day. ideally three. Sometimes I go four, but I'm a little neurotic with that stuff. When it comes to your health, brushing your teeth is one of the most important parts of your day. That's why Quip has combined dentistry and design to make new electronic toothbrush that packs just the right amount of vibration into a slimmer design at a fraction of the cost of the traditional electric toothbrushes. With Quip, guiding pulses alert you when to switch sides, making brushing the right amount effortless. It even comes with a mount that suctions right to your mirror and can be used as a cover for hygienic travel everywhere. That's awesome. And Quip's subscription plan refreshes your brush on a dentist recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. No wonder Quip is backed by a network of over 10,000 dental professionals and was named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of the year. Find out for yourself. Quip starts at just $25. And if you go to quip.com/majority right now, you get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/majority. That's getquip.com/majority. Okay, everybody, this is an interview Sam recorded, I believe it was yesterday, with Ari Berman on how the GOP rigs elections. It's Ari's brand new piece in Rolling Stone. Going to do that interview, then come back to me, and we will see you in the fun half. I could sleep.
I could sleep. I could sleep. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is always a pleasure to welcome back to the program Ari Berman. He is a senior writer with Mother Jones Magazine, author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. And his piece, How the GOP Rigs Elections, can be found in this month's Rolling Stone magazine. Ari, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Sam. Thanks for having me back.
This piece is basically a look at the myriad of ways Republicans are now actually rigging elections. We've been hearing the words rigging, and you're looking at these different ways, and we'll get into what those different ways are, but you're specifically looking at Wisconsin. Why Wisconsin?
I decided to look at Wisconsin because Wisconsin was really a model for good governance for so many years. It had some of the best voting laws in the country. It had some of the most competitive elections in the country. It had some of the best campaign finance and good government laws in the country. And it was a solidly purple to sometimes even blue-leaning state. And all of that has just been demolished by Scott Walker and Republicans. It now has some of the worst voter suppression laws in the country. It has some of the worst gerrymandering in the country. They've completely destroyed the campaign finance system, and they've taken a progressive purple state and turned it very, very deep red. And so I think this is not just a story of a state changing politically. It's a story of a state really eviscerating all of the things that made it a model. And Wisconsin went from one model, which was this place that Teddy Roosevelt once called a laboratory for progressive legislation, and it's become another model, which is the laboratory for the Koch brothers to basically figure out how to create a plutocratic oligarchical society that benefits the 1% at the expense of everyone else. And so I just think that Wisconsin is a perfect test case to look at what Republicans have done to democracy more broadly.
Okay, all right. So it raises two questions before we get into the details here. One is, do you think Wisconsin was chosen, or was that happenstance? In other words, because it was a model for so many years of democracy and of progressivism, do you think that's why the Koch brothers went in there and decided, hey, we're going to find our guy there? It ended up being Scott Walker back when he was a county supervisor, I think it was. And we're going to lard this guy up with American for Prosperity money. Was that happenstance? Was it just they put this money into five or six states and this is the one that popped? Why Wisconsin?
No, I think Wisconsin was chosen to be the guinea pig for the Koch brothers and other conservative billionaires, because I think they knew that if they were able to crush unions in the state that invented public sector unions, the state that invented Social Security, the state that invented public schools, all of these things. I mean, Wisconsin is a state that has really led the way in terms of being a laboratory of progressivism. If they were able to crush progressivism here and turn that state red, then that would have a ripple effect all across the country. So, I mean, there were some circumstances that made Wisconsin favorable. There were some conservative billionaires already there. There was some conservative infrastructure already there. But no, it was chosen because they knew that whatever they did in Wisconsin would have national significance. And that's why Scott Walker made such a big show out of crushing unions, because he wanted to export this model all across the country. And then they did all of these other things that were more under the radar, like the gerrymandering, the voter suppression, the dark money that they've been exporting as well.
So we have like a proof of concept type of situation where this thing can be exported. All right. So before we get into those three aspects of the rigging, has there been a change ideologically amongst the people in Wisconsin? Like, you know, I mean, I was in Madison for the protests against Scott Walker when this was basically, they started to unleash this stuff. Has there been, in that period of time or since before then, has there been an ideological change? I mean, obviously the political makeup is different of the state than it has been in the past. But if people were to poll people on issues that they have been revisited over the years in Wisconsin, has that changed?
I don't think it's changed all that much. I think the mechanisms of power have changed. I think what Republicans have done is they were able to win one election, the 2010 election, when things were very, very bad for Democrats. And then they manipulated all the rules to be able to stay in power. They gerrymandered the maps to stay in power. They passed laws to make it harder for Democrats to vote. They crushed unions, which were the number one organizing ally of the Democratic Party. They passed right-to-work laws, which depressed Democratic turnout and organizing abilities. They unleashed a flood of money that Democrats could never compete with. And so I think that is more notable than people actually changing. There certainly were some things in Wisconsin that went badly for Democrats. Clearly, Hillary Clinton was not a popular candidate there. Clearly, the Democratic Party is not as strong as it should be there because they haven't come close to defeating Walker so far. But I think the way that they have rigged the system in their benefit, I think explains more than anything else why they still remain in power, now 8 years after the 2010 election.
All right. And this is a little bit off topic, and then we're going to get to the heart of what you're arguing. But do you think Democrats are ever going to learn that lesson?
Democrats are learning this. I think in 2018, Democrats have learned this lesson more than in any year past, which is that the states are the laboratories of change in this country. That at a time when so many people are fixated on Donald Trump and so many people are fixated on a very, very dysfunctional Congress, the Republican agenda is moving in all of these states. And everything that Trump is doing, with the exception of maybe the Muslim ban, has been tried in Republican states already. The entire agenda is coming from Wisconsin to Congress and the White House, not the other way around. And so I really think that this is the first time I've seen Democrats focus on state legislative races, for example, the first time I've seen them focus seriously on Secretary of State races, the first time that I've seen them focus on state Supreme Court races. I mean, this is critically important because Republicans realized, I mean, 30 years ago they realized this. When Democrats had a very durable majorities in Congress, they realized if we take back the states, we can implement our entire agenda. And then when Obama took the White House, they realized they could essentially nullify 8 years of the first black president if they controlled all the states instead.
Well, no, I guess I would agree with you. I think that Democrats for the first time are showing at least an awareness of the importance of these statewide races. And I don't just mean the Democratic leadership. I mean, I think there is an energy amongst just sort of typical voters and, you know, new activists and whatnot about the importance of that. But what I'm asking specifically is, you know, you look back to 2008, right? The Democrats come in, they have a majority in the Senate, the majority in the House. They have a veto-proof majority in the Senate for a shorter period, I think, than people remember, but it was there. They ran on EFCA, right? This is the card check. This is, make it easier to unionize. So in other words, do you think Democrats have learned the lesson that when we get into power, our first order of business should be to make sure that we enhance our ability to stay in power? Right. Like honestly, like that is the understanding that Republicans have. Their first order of business.
Yeah, that's the first priority. The first priority of Republicans is always give as many tax breaks as possible to our donors, make it as difficult as possible for our opponents to organize, make it so that we can't be voted out of office no matter what happens because we've gerrymandered the district so badly. Have Democrats done the alternative thing? No, not at all. I think in some cases, Democrats are starting to think about this, thinking about ways, for example, to expand the electorate so that there's a larger pool of voters that would potentially vote Democratic. Now, I think you should just do that for democracy's sake.
Right.
I think you should just make it easy to vote, and whoever wins.
Well, that's the thing.
When Tim Pawlenty won in Minnesota with Election Day registration, I didn't criticize Minnesota's election for letting Pawlenty won. I thought it was a good thing that Minnesota had these laws. So, but I do think that this is still asymmetric warfare in terms of how the parties think about the legislative process and their base. I think you're absolutely right about that.
I mean, and the advantage theoretically the Democrats have is that they can just simply be pro-democracy, you know, a big D democracy or small D democracy, I should say, and achieve, you know, benefits to them as a party. But all right, so let's get into the Wisconsin agenda. You say this is how Republicans rig the elections. Let's start with the gerrymandering. You know, there has been a debate in academic circles as to whether or not 2014 in particular, I guess, was a function. The Republicans taking over 2014 was a function of gerrymandering, or is it natural sorting? Now, it seems to me conceivable that there's some natural sorting that's going out around the country where like-minded people are like, hey, man, we're all going to go to Asheville, North Carolina, and there's going to be a blip of Democrats there because we all like the lifestyle. But when you look around Wisconsin, natural sorting or completely engineered gerrymandering?
Well, I think it can be both, right? It's not an either-or thing. There could be sorting and there can also be gerrymandering. But, I mean, you spend any amount of time in a state like Wisconsin and you immediately see the gerrymandering. And, you know, my article in Rolling Stone begins with the story of this Republican state senator, Van Wongard, who is a former cop, not a particularly impressive guy. He won a state Senate race in the Racine area in a very competitive swing state Senate district in 2010. Then he voted for Scott Walker's anti-union bill, which really made a lot of people angry in Racine because he had been, as a cop, someone who negotiated his benefits with the police union. So he was then recalled in 2012, was defeated by a Democrat. And then what happened was the Republican gerrymandering went into effect after the 2010 census. And the way his district was drawn, and I honestly, Sam, I've studied a lot of gerrymandering. This is the most insane one I've ever seen. They drew his district so that his block stayed in Racine because he didn't want to move. But all of his Democratic neighbors in Racine were drawn out of his district. So literally, it's his house. You go two houses down, and the district ends, and it becomes a new Republican district that includes all of the rural areas of Racine and of Kenosha, because what they did is there were two separate 50-50 state Senate districts in Racine and Kenosha. They were both competitive districts. They favored Democrats in the past, but they were both competitive districts. What Republicans did is they put all the Democrats in Racine and Kenosha and the cities and combined them. Then they gave this one state senator that I write about, this guy, Van Wongard, all of the Republican areas. So he has his house in his Democratic neighborhood, and then he has all of the Republican areas so that he'll easily get elected. So that's not sorting, Sam.
Right.
That is a dramatic pinpoint to the House engineering of the lines to turn a swing district into what is now a 16-point Republican district. And this guy who was recalled because he was so unpopular after voting for Scott Walker's anti-union stuff basically can't be defeated anymore because all of his neighbors are these crazy gun-toting farmer types in the rural areas of Wisconsin.
So, okay, so we see the engineering. Tell us the story of how that worked. I mean, you write about a secret map making room that was established in 2010. I mean, it really
the secret society we've all been looking for.
Exactly.
This is also another just unbelievable thing because remember, redistricting is a public process, right? It's financed by taxpayer money. So you'd think there'd be some sort of transparency here. But basically what Wisconsin Republicans did is they outsourced the entire redistricting process to a law firm that was across the street from the legislature. And members of the legislature who were Republicans went over to this law firm that they were showed to this place called the Map Room, where they had to sign confidentiality agreements, where no Democrats saw the map, where the entire thing was completely secret. And then the districts were introduced, and a week later there was one public hearing, and then they were passed. And so this entire process, which is completely secret, Democrats were totally shut out, and the entire thing was funded with taxpayer money, even though the public had absolutely no say in the entire process. And what it did is it basically took a 50-50 state and gave Republicans about 60% of the legislature, no matter what happened, because you look at 2012, for example. In 2012, Obama wins Wisconsin by 7 points. Democrats get 51% of seats for the state legislature, but Republicans win 60 of 99 seats. So basically, the legislature is engineered in such a way that it's nearly impossible for Democrats to take over. I mean, 2018 is going to be a very, very good test case because I think you'll have the dynamics will favor Democrats more than any other election in years, possibly even decades. But it's still not clear to me that they're going to be able to take that back the Wisconsin legislature because of the gerrymandering. And I think that's what Republicans have done here. They've basically predetermined the outcomes. I'm not saying that Democrats won't win or they won't win back some seats, but to take back the legislature would just require such extraordinary circumstances because of the way these maps are drawn.
I mean, that's what we saw in Virginia, right? I mean, the Democrats won 58% or 59% of the vote, and yet they got like 49% of the seats. I mean, there's a clear disparity there. You want to bring those numbers in some measure into alignment. Well, let me ask you this. Are there no state statutes that govern this process? I mean, like, are you just when you're in power, you can do whatever you want in terms of these redistricting?
Well, that's what's really interesting is that Democrats took this to court in Wisconsin, and the maps were struck down. A federal court said that they were intended, in the court's words, to burden the representational rights of Democratic voters. So basically, the court said this was illegal partisan gerrymandering, and now this case is going to the Supreme Court, and it's going to have a very, very significant impact. So, I mean, basically, Wisconsin became this test case where Democrats said, you know, you did this solely to prevent us from having any sort of power. The courts agreed, and now the Supreme Court is going to hear it. So, I mean, what happened in Wisconsin isn't just important because it's a swing state, but now it's really this test case for what the Supreme Court's going to do about gerrymandering more broadly.
And are they waiting? What's the status of those cases? I mean, are they waiting for other cases to join them or something?
So the status is that the oral arguments happened in the Wisconsin case in October, and now we're just waiting for a ruling, which may not come until June, which is the end of the Supreme Court's term.
Okay.
They've also scheduled another case out of Maryland, which is a Democratic gerrymander. And Maryland was one of the few places where Democrats had one-party control. And they gerrymandered the maps to prevent Republicans from having power. And so Republicans challenged that, too, and that's before the Supreme Court. And some people think that the court may want to hear both these cases so that if it strikes down partisan gerrymandering, it'll do it both for Republicans and for Democrats, basically saying we can be consistent here, that no matter which party does it, it's wrong. That's one theory as to why they would take two partisan gerrymandering cases in the same term. They're also possibly going to hear a case out of North Carolina and a case out of Texas that's about racial gerrymandering, which the Supreme Court's been a little bit clearer on striking down racial gerrymandering, but just the partisan gerrymandering is much more present because every state does it. Every state draws maps that, unless you have an independent commission, you try to, one party tries to exclude the other party. And so if the Supreme Court was to put a check on this for the first time, I think that would have a really big impact, particularly going into 2020 when there's likely to be many more contested races and there's likely to be more scrutiny of the process in general.
If I remember correctly, the big question is whether or not Anthony Kennedy, who's dealt with these gerrymandering cases in the past, and I think this is accurate. His argument was like, look, if we had a way in which we could actually measure what a non-gerrymandered district looks like, or a reasonably gerrymandered district to look like, then I'd be more inclined to do this. But we're stumbling around the dark. We don't have that way. And the big supposed breakthrough within the Wisconsin case is that there is social science now that has developed an algorithm, if you will, or a metric to determine sort of how many votes are wasted in a district and sort of like what is unreasonably gerrymandered. Is that right?
Yeah, and I mean exactly what John Roberts called sociological gobbledygook, which evidently he couldn't, with his two Harvard degrees, wasn't able to grasp. But basically, that this was the big thing they did in Wisconsin. They developed this thing called the efficiency gap, and they said when there's a situation where one party has so many wasted votes, it's a clear partisan gerrymander. There also were some other tests that were floated that if you can show, for example, that one party was able to get a majority of votes but a minority of seats, which happened in Wisconsin, then that could be another thing. Kennedy might not rule on that part of it. He's also potentially going to rule on a First Amendment thing, basically saying that, you know, if one party is so disadvantaged by the process, that may actually burden their First Amendment right to free association. So we don't totally know how he's going to go down here, but it's absolutely true that in the last decade, particularly as gerrymandering has gotten worse, the social science research has gotten more precise in identifying gerrymandering, which also could be used to strike down Democratic or Republican gerrymanders, basically meaning it's a party-neutral test. If Democrats do it to Republicans, you can figure that out as well.
Right. Okay, so let's move on to the second means in which they're rigging elections. And I was just saying before we spoke that I saw a tweet earlier this week that made me think of you, basically because of your work on your book, Give Us the Ballot, where someone had was critiquing the notion that voting doesn't matter, and that saying something like, you know, people say, like, if voting mattered, they'd make it illegal. And the retort was, they are. They are making it illegal, right?
Yeah. And been paying attention. Yeah.
Yeah. And that is, I mean, that's sort of like, I wouldn't say phase two. That's just sort of like one of the other arrows in the quiver. How have they done that in Wisconsin?
Well, Wisconsin passed one of the strictest voter ID laws in the country, meaning that everyone has to have government-issued ID to vote, particularly certain forms of ID. And in Wisconsin, 9% of registered voters don't have those forms of ID, and the people that don't have them are disproportionately poor, disproportionately more likely to be people of color, disproportionately more likely to vote Democratic. And you know, I was in Wisconsin on Election Day 2016, and I've written a lot about this. And I think the law had a tremendous impact in Wisconsin, particularly among Black voters in Milwaukee, where 70% of African Americans live. Because I've now told multiple stories of people in Wisconsin. I just told a story in this piece of a woman named Charisma Townsend, who was a 24-year-old who misplaced her driver's license before Election Day, but she brought her electricity bill, her student ID, and a picture of her ID on her phone to show to poll workers. So she had three different pieces of ID to show who she was, but none of them were accepted under the law, and so she wasn't able to vote. And it just, if you look at the numbers here, I mean, they're pretty astonishing. There was a study by the University of Wisconsin that found that 23,000 voters in two counties alone, in Madison and Milwaukee, weren't able to vote because of the voter ID law. Donald Trump only won the state by 22,000 votes. And if you look statewide, up to 45,000 people were prevented from voting. And we know this has a clear racial impact, that black voters said 3 times as likely as whites to not vote because of the ID law. This is one of those things where a lot of people say, you know, what's the big deal? Everyone has an ID. But if you look at Wisconsin, you see very, very clearly that not everyone has an ID, that it disproportionately impacted a certain groups of people, and that it has a real big impact in close elections. And not only that, but the state wrote the law in such an obvious way to discriminate against certain people compared to others. So, for example, they didn't really accept any student IDs under the law, even though a University of Wisconsin ID is a government-issued photo ID. There also were things like in Milwaukee, the state of Wisconsin ran ads at movie theaters about the voter ID law, but they didn't run a single ad in Milwaukee, which is the place where 70% of African Americans in the state live. So, I mean, there was just a lot of chicanery going on. And in fact, on the day of Wisconsin's primary in April 2016, a prominent Republican, Glenn Grothman, was asked why a Republican would win the state, and he said, "Now we have photo ID." So this. Republicans said this privately, they said this publicly, but they knew the election was going to be close. They knew they had lost close elections, and they were looking for any sort of advantage that they could get. Because remember, you can only gerrymander state legislative maps and U.S. House maps. You can't gerrymander a presidential election. And that's why the voter suppression stuff is so important, because that's essentially how they gerrymandered the presidential election as well.
Right. Gerrymandering doesn't work when you're talking also about, you know, let's say the Senate seat or something like that.
Yeah,
you need to
exactly.
Find some other mechanism. And you and I have talked about this many, many times in the past. But all of this is also done in the wake of the U.S. Supreme Court gutting the Voting Rights Act, right? And in Wisconsin, I don't know if it was a pre-clearance state anyways. My guess it probably was not. But I imagine that all of these states were very taxing. To have some non-pre-clearance states, it meant that there was a lot more fires to be put out and a lot less resources to deal with a state like Wisconsin.
Exactly. I mean, and I think that's one of the reasons why the Justice Department never got involved with suing Wisconsin, because they were so busy suing North Carolina and Texas that they could only go after so many places. And I think this started really after the 2010 election. There were efforts before to suppress votes, but it really expanded dramatically after 2010 when 23 states passed new restrictions on voting. And I think what was so notable is that it didn't just happen in southern states. Like Mississippi or Alabama, that had happened in states like Wisconsin, where you had not had these same fights over voting. And not only that, but you had the courts actually uphold some of these laws. So a lot of people think, well, oh, we just defeated all of these voter suppression laws because there were rulings in North Carolina and Texas. But Wisconsin was a state where the courts actually upheld these restrictions on voting. Republican-appointed judges upheld these restrictions on voting. And so, for me, the 2016 election in Wisconsin was a slow-motion train wreck, because I saw that so many people didn't have these IDs and it was going to be a huge problem. Then when the election was so close, it turned out that thousands of people weren't able to vote as a result. And Wisconsin remains a perennial swing state. It's a state where Scott Walker's up in 2018, a lot of competitive races, even in spite of the gerrymandering. And so this is really, really important to look at.
And two points, you know, the project to inhibit people's right to vote via these voter ID laws, you know, was evident back as far back and probably before this, but certainly in the aughts when Karl Rove, the firing of U.S. attorneys that was taking place across the country was the failure of some of these U.S. attorneys to deliver, you know, fraudulent voter fraud cases ended up being a grounds for dismissal in the Bush administration. And I guess the other point I just wanted to add, last time we spoke, you had done a piece about efforts in Wisconsin under the auspices of the ACLU to actually, like, literally go out and individually get people the right to vote.
Yeah.
Work through these obstacles, because all of this, of course, is just about obstacles that are put in place. It's almost like the opposite of a sales pitch, right? Like, we're going to remove all obstacles to make it easy for you to buy this. In this instance, we're going to put every single obstacle in front of you to make sure that you have a harder time to vote. So there are organizations that are sort of like addressing it on that level, not the legalistic, but the mechanical one.
Yeah, they are. They are. And I mean, I think in states where these laws have been upheld in court, places like the ACLU, there's also new organizations like Spread the Vote, have had to devote a tremendous amount of resources to helping people get the IDs they need. And that's very, very taxing work. It's very time consuming. It's very labor intensive. They've made a lot of progress. But again, I mean, there's just so many people who don't have the IDs they need and run into one problem or another trying to get the IDs. And so I don't see this problem going away anytime soon, unfortunately.
All right. So the next, I guess, sort of like ingredient in this toxic brew to rig these elections is takes us back again to the Koch brothers in many respects and Scott Walker. And that is the dark money. Tell us about that. And it is also, there's certain irony here too, because, you know, Russ Feingold is so closely associated with attempts at campaign finance reform.
Well, I mean, as I said when we first talked, I mean, Wisconsin had some of the best campaign finance laws in the country, some of the strictest laws in terms of disclosure and things like that. And Republicans basically destroyed this entire system. And the first thing that happened is that when Scott Walker, who had been very close to the Koch brothers and other conservative billionaires, when he was recalled, when there was a recall election for him in 2012, he had to figure out how to raise enough money to win. And what happened was Walker had to disclose his donors, and there were also limits on how much he could spend. So instead of actually raising money for his campaign, Walker did this amazing thing where he ran around to all of these people, the Koch brothers, even Donald Trump he met with, and he told them instead of giving money to his campaign, they should give it to this other group called Wisconsin Club for Growth, which was an extension of the National Club for Growth that was supporting his campaign. And basically, there were all of these emails, which were eventually released by The Guardian, where essentially Walker's campaign says these outside groups don't have to disclose their donors, and they have no limits on the amount of money they can raise because of the Citizens United decision. So there was this tremendous secret fundraising scheme to give as much money as possible to Walker, but not to his campaign through these outside dark money groups. And this ended up being a huge issue in Wisconsin. There was a major investigation. There was a criminal scheme that was alleged for improper fundraising for Scott Walker. And what happened was the Wisconsin Supreme Court, which had gotten money from the same groups that were funding Walker, because justices are elected in Wisconsin,
yes,
shut the investigation down. And then after they shut the investigation down, they completely changed all of the campaign finance laws so that politicians like Walker could coordinate with outside groups, that donors could give more money, that corporations could give directly to political parties. All of this stuff was totally changed, that Wisconsin went from having the best campaign finance laws in the country to the worst campaign finance laws in the country. And it's actually still going on today because the Wisconsin legislature is now trying to oust the ethics and elections director in the states before the 2018 elections because they helped lead the investigations into Scott Walker's fundraising. So, I mean, this is just a microcosm of what Republicans have done all across the country in the wake of Citizens United. And I think in many ways, we've kind of just become accustomed to this system that, oh, people are just going to raise, as much money as they want from billionaires, and that's just the way it's going to be. Like, you know, Republicans pass the tax bill, and then the Koch brothers give Paul Ryan $500,000. People
Right.
are just kind of become okay with that. But when you step back and think about it, I mean, it's just an incredible system of legalized corruption that we have occurring in this country. And I think, you know, both parties exploit it, but Republicans are always going to exploit it more because they have more rich billionaires. And not only do they have more rich billionaires, they have more rich billionaires who want to rig the economic system and the political system for their own benefit. So, I mean, I think this is a major problem. And not just on the national level, but it's a major problem in state races where these races are often, you don't need that much money to buy a state.
Right. A dollar is just much more valuable in a small media market than it is somewhere else. And you can put it, I mean, it's It's cheaper to run.
So the Koch brothers can swoop in and spend $1 million on a local race. That has a tremendous amount of impact. And this really bothers me, not just because of the money, but because of the outcomes it leads to. I don't think this tax bill ever would have passed if it hadn't have been for the Citizens United decision. I mean, do you think so, Sam? It was so unpopular. From the very beginning.
You had Republican lawmakers who were explicitly saying, like, I have to do this. My donors
are explicitly saying, my donors are making me do this.
And which is a stunning indictment of the rest of society. Like, oh, they actually believe this is an excuse. And on some level, that was taken like, yeah, they're boxed in because if they don't do this, they're going to have no donors. Okay. Here's the question I keep returning to, and maybe, you know, this is not one. And, you know, I have good friends in Wisconsin who are, traveling the state for in political positions. And I've never gotten a satisfactory answer to this. Like, where is the response in Wisconsin? Like, is there a political failure? Is there a Democratic Party failure in Wisconsin to communicate what you have communicated to us today? Am I overestimating the ease in which that can be done? I mean, why are they allowed to run roughshod over all these process issues, which also then have deeply, meaningful implications in terms of public policy, whether it's, you know, the cheese care or whatever. I can't remember what they called the Wisconsin, healthcare initiatives or, the right to union, to unionize, to work under a union contract. I mean, where is the pushback?
Well, I think we've seen a lot of pushback in Wisconsin with the protests, for example. But I think it's really a microcosm for what you can do when you take power, when you have very powerful allies, very wealthy allies, and when you can manipulate the rules of the game. I mean, it really only took them winning one election and then changing all the mechanisms of government to be able to hold power. And that might not last forever, but it's been 8 years now and they've been able to ride it out. And so I think that it's not so much a failure of Democrats to communicate this, it's a failure of them to have the power to do anything about it, because they don't control the legislature. And it's very, very difficult for them to win it back. And so I think the Democratic Party is weak in Wisconsin, and I think it's weak in a lot of places, and I think it's partly weak because of laws that have been passed. I think the anti-union law in Wisconsin, both the initial one ending collective bargaining for public sector unions, but also the right to work law that Scott Walker said he would never sign that they passed in 2015, that just decimated unions in the state. There's an incredible statistic that Alabama now has more union members than Wisconsin, which is just unreal to think about. And I think that Scott Walker deliberately demobilized the most important ally of the Democratic Party in Wisconsin and also nationally, the ally that has historically fought for populist economics in the state and in the country more broadly. And so I think Democrats have not recovered from that in Wisconsin. They've lost so much money. They've lost so many organizing members. And so they're just starting from such an uphill place. And yeah, they have some good people. They have Tammy Baldwin in the Senate. She's going to face a very tough race in 2018. Obama was able to win the state twice. So it's not like all is lost. Right. But I'm just saying, my whole point was, I kept hearing over and over and over about Democratic enthusiasm heading into 2018. And I don't want to be the guy at the party that just depresses everybody and nobody wants to talk to that person. I don't want to be that person.
I'm that guy.
But I felt like we needed to have a little bit of a reality check about, number one, what's happening to our democracy, because I think that's the most important thing. But secondarily, the issues that Democrats are going to have to face in this election and in future elections. And I think if they don't figure out how to deal with these three issues, even if they are able to win one election because of unprecedented unpopularity of Trump, it's going to bite them in the ass in the future.
That's right. I mean, that gets back to learning the lesson that when you get into office, first order of business should be making sure that you have, at the very least, reformed the mechanisms that allowed this type of abuse to take place. Ari Berman, how the GOP rigs elections. Always a pleasure. Thanks, man.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Hey, folks. Welcome back. We're going to go to the fun half. And we've got a lot of stories to talk about. Much sound. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. Check out the jet.com link. Subscribe to the show on iTunes. Leave us a review. Subscribe to it on YouTube. Check out Facebook. You can follow all of us on Twitter. Of course, you can find me at the Michael Brooks Show on the YouTube channel or Michael Brooks Show on iTunes. 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. We will see you in the fun half.